Hello, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora Radio. Today we have with us author Tanya James. She was raised in Louisville, Kentucky, or I guess Louisville, Kentucky, and she lives in the Washington, D.C. area with her husband and young son. She published her debut novel, Atlas of the Unknowns, in 2009, published by Knopf, and it was a New York Times editor's choice. She then wrote her next book, Aerograms, which I particularly like, which was the best book of 2012, and was a terrific book. Her stories have appeared in the Boston Review, Kenyon Review, Public Space, and many other places. Two stories from Aerograms were finalists for the Best American Short Stories in 2008 and 2013. Tanya is the recipient of fellowships from the Ragdale Foundation and the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities. From 2011 to 2012, she also is a Fulbright Fellow living in New Delhi. Tanya, welcome to our show.
Hi, Amar. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I'm a big fan of your book, so it's, I guess, a double pleasure for me here.
Oh, thank you.
So let's just talk a little bit about you. Were you born in Louisville, or did you come over from India? Just take us through how you got to Louisville.
Well, I was born in Chicago, and I used to cling to that part of my bio when I was a little kid, because I thought Chicago seemed to have this kind of romance. But I was actually raised in Louisville. You did that well, Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think my parents kind of went from big city to big city to big city, you know, New York and Baltimore and Chicago. And then they ultimately felt, I think, that Louisville was the right size for them.
And what did your parents do? I mean,
my mom is a homemaker, and my dad is a doctor. He's a cardiologist.
Again, you belong to the doctor, lawyer, engineer part of the Indian community.
Oh, my God, you have no idea. Everyone in my family is a doctor.
Yeah.
I think everyone in my husband's family is a doctor as well.
Oh, my God.
We're the black sheep.
Yeah, I'll come to that later in a minute. But how was it growing up in Kentucky? Because that wasn't known as a big hotspot for Indian immigrants, you know?
You know, I have to say one thing that I always thought that everyone growing up in America learns their state song and learns their state motto and the state bird. But, you know, I was talking to my husband who's from Connecticut, and he didn't know any of those things. So it just occurred to me that Kentucky, you know, there's like a real pride about living in Kentucky, and you know, I just grew up with the sense that Kentucky is sort of, you know, this punchline in mainstream media, and I would, you know, I'd get kind of riled up when I'd hear jokes in movies about how Kentuckians don't wear shoes and they're all inbred, and so, you know, I felt like a Kentuckian in a sense, you know, I felt kind of defensive of Kentucky in a sense, but I also felt a bit outside of that sort of profound, you know, regional identity that comes from having generations, you know, putting down roots and really knowing the local history. So, you know, I have these, you know, sort of extremes where I feel very connected to Kentucky and yet sort of on the periphery when I was growing up.
And I have to ask you this. I was at the Kentucky Derby once. Have you ever gone there?
You know, I did. I did go to the Derby, and I probably had a little too much fun. But you know, we didn't have Facebook back then, so thankfully all those stories are
sure
locked in the vault.
I'm sure you sang "Old Kentucky Home" at the Derby.
I probably did. We'll leave that out.
I was there in probably the milestone year when the last Triple Crown winner was crowned. So that was a long time ago.
Oh, was that a long time ago? I don't remember. I mean, I haven't really. I vaguely follow it.
Anyway, so coming back to your roots, you know, family of doctors and stuff. How did you fall in love with books and how did you get into taking up writing as a career? You know, it's not as potentially lucrative as being a doctor. It's really not a conventional choice. How did you get there?
Yeah, you know, my father is a really big reader, and he still has this library of leather-bound books, and it always felt like a kind of, you know, we never had any room with religious, you know, iconography or anything, but but that felt like the most sacred space of the house in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really treasured certain books and the way he would talk about them. It's sort of infectious, that enthusiasm for literature. And, you know, I think in the beginning I just loved, you know, when I was a kid, I loved the French novelists, like these big kind of adventurous novels, the Three Musketeers and all those sequels and all the melodrama and the corsets. And, you know, and I also loved, you know, genre things like Agatha Christie or, you know, Ray Bradbury or Stephen King. And I just, you know, I just loved the thrill of those stories. And, you know, I wanted to do to other people what those stories had done to me as a reader. And, you know, I tried hard, you know, when I was a kid, and I wrote a novella about a boy who joins a boys' school and they're all droids. Anyway, I fancied myself this like sci-fi writer. But until later in high school, when I started to think about character and I started to think about, you know, relationships to characters and why I cared for them or why I didn't, and about language and, you know, the acoustics of language or the aesthetics of a sentence. And, you know, I remember in high school I had this teacher that I loved, and she introduced us to Toni Morrison. I mean, through books, not Toni Morrison the person, but I just mimicked the hell out of her. I would just try to write every story in this kind of rhythmic and jazzy voice. But, and, you know, I just, every writer I worshipped, I would just try to mimic them. And but, you know, that's sort of part of the process. You know, you're trying to figure out why you love what you love. And but I think it was around that time, you know, when I was probably 17 or 18, that I was starting to think about writing from a kind of writerly perspective or from a craft perspective, and trying to take stories apart the way, you know, someone might take a computer apart and try to figure out, what is it? Like, how did this person make this work? How did they fabricate a whole world and make me believe in it?
And how did your parents react to that when you said this is going to be potentially your profession?
Well, it was a long series of chain reactions, I guess. I mean, yeah. I sort of thought I'd go to college, and I remember, you know, speaking to a former Harvard graduate who, you know, my mother put me in touch with her. She's brilliant, and she had all these, you know, advice about what to major in and what classes to take, and they were all in the kind of economics and applied math realm. And, you know, I was like, okay, and I wrote down, I took notes, I was like, good, that's what I'm going to do. And I went and I took Ec-10, economics, and then I also took this course called Black Cinema or something like exploring whether there is a genre such as African-American cinema. And, you know, the first film we saw was Pulp Fiction, and I was like, I that's it. This is definitely going to be my major. So I became a film major. And something about film, I think, was a little more reassuring than writing, because there's all the technical stuff to it. Like, there just seems like a whole industry around film. But you know, my dad was always really excited about the idea of someone in the family, I think, doing something non-traditional or something kind of creative. I mean, he's very supportive of the doctors in our family as well. But I think, you know, he's sort of always had this kind of adventurous streak to him. And then, you know, my mom, she had her own misgivings, but I've come to learn that she was completely right, as all mothers always are. You know, you know, the field of writing is really, you know, it's very unpredictable, and so it's so much outside of your control. And so, you know, she's never the type of person to kind of block your path to something, but I think she was always questioning in a way that was, I think in retrospect, I feel like it was actually, you know, she had the right instincts. But you know, on the other hand, I think sometimes having someone question you and express their doubts makes you try harder, and it made me try harder in a way.
So what's the genesis of your first book, Atlas of the Unknown? So this was in 2009. An agent, a publisher, how did all that happen?
Well, if we're talking about the inspiration behind the book, because I had started writing the book before I got an agent, but I remember back then, you know, maybe 2008 I was writing, or 2007, And I was, back then I was living in New York, and I remember if you wanted to get your eyebrows threaded, and this was sort of insider information of all, you know, Indian young women, you had to go to Queens. You know, now there are threaders and Indian salons on every other block, but back then it was, you had to get on the Q train and end up in this whole other kind of world, a sort of Little India type of world. And I had done an interview for the New York Times about these threaders at an Indian beauty salon, and somehow that sort of contained world seemed exciting to me and interesting. And then another time, you know, I find inspiration to be sort of a cumulative process. You know, there's like a number of different sparks that kind of happen in, you know, around the same time. And another one was when I went to the library and there was an exhibit on migration, and it was sort of depicting the pattern of migration as being one way and linear. And I thought, well, that doesn't quite jive with, you know, my understanding of migration. So but anyway, you know, all these kinds of things were sort of swirling in my head, and I started writing. And, you know, I had a collection of short stories, and I had maybe half the novel when I, you know, started sending my work out to agents. And sort of my dream agent took me on. And, and you know, the process, it just is very mysterious and happens very quickly. But fortunately for me, she sent it out to an editor who she thought would work well with these with me and who would be into this work, and it was sort of the first editor we went to took the novel and the story, so we're kind of lucky in that way.
Oh, that's fantastic! And then next comes Aerograms, which was part of Oprah's summer reading in 2012. There were many accolades for the book, and this was the book that I personally loved. You know, especially the stories about the wrestlers. I'm sure you know that story well. So what was behind that short story?
Well, you know, actually, I had been doing some research on the Indian students' movement in the turn of the century, at turn of the 20th century in London, the movement for, you know, Indian independence. And in that reading, it was sort of dry and, you know, sort of what you think of when you think of research. But I came across this book, this really old book that was on microfilm, and it was called Strong Men Over the Years. And it was this account of Indian wrestlers around the turn of the century. And there's this, you know, a profile on each one along with this very kind of, you know, posed picture. And two of those wrestlers were Gama the Great and his brother Imam. And, you know, I never would have thought, like, wrestling is something I want to write about. I've never been attracted to that sport. I find, you know, I used to find it really, it just seems just, you know, grappling. It's constantly, you know, shoving at each other. It's like football, but without the kind of dramatic passes. But then the more I read about these men and the details of their lives, I mean, this writer was able to get very close to them. And, you know, it's such a rigorous way of life. I mean, it's not even simply a sport. It sort of, you know, I'm talking about, you know, Pilwani kind of wrestling, this traditional, you know, Indian form that affects, you know, the not only just your physical self, but the way you look at the world. You know, and when I was reading about Gama and Imam, you know, they had all these kind of questions when they were coming to London for the first time. They were coming to compete. And, you know, one of the things that they found odd was, you know, why would anyone wear these suits, these Western suits that are so tight and so constraining? And I just thought that was, you know, kind of great. You know, I just thought, you know, the more I could get under their skin in this way and understand how maybe they were at odds with that world they were in, the more it seemed like a, you know, a fertile place for fiction.
No, that was a great story. And by the way, you had two different short stories from the book listed under Best American Short Stories. What were the two stories that made it to the finals?
Well, there was one in a couple years ago called Aerograms, well, the title story. And then a couple years later, there were actually two more. There's one called The Scriptological Review. It was about a guy who's obsessed with handwriting analysis, and then the wrestler stories also.
That was great. So I know you, in 2013, you went to the famous Jaipur Lit Festival. How was that? Did you enjoy that? It's always filled with controversy and great people attending and stuff. So what was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a couple times now.
Yeah.
Getting just when you think it can't get any bigger, it gets bigger. But it's really unlike any festival I've been to in the world. I mean, that's just kind of, I think that maybe somehow Indian people have mastered the element of the spectacle. I mean, mm-hmm. they really try to have fun with this festival. And that's just not true of all festivals. I think a lot of festivals, sometimes it can just feel like a conference and you're just looking at these panels. And but I think that, you know, they really try to, you know, inject a certain level of entertainment. And, like, you know, they have these incredible musical performances and poets. And they also have, you know, fabulous panels. But they also try to maintain this balance between regional authors, because I think a lot of times, you know, regional authors can get easily sort of swallowed up in these international sort of events.
Right.
But it's I think what makes it so amazing is that people just come from everywhere. I mean, I've met, you know, high school students who will just cram into a car as if this is Woodstock or something. and you know, they will go, and it's just an exodus. And it's free. And, you know,
yeah.
and the audiences are always packed, and which is so gratifying as a writer because, you know, mm-hmm. I know every writer I know has faced, you know, five empty chairs. Or, you know, we've all done those readings. And so it's just so great when these audiences are packed and they're passionate and they have questions and comments, and sometimes their comments go on forever, but that's
yeah.
okay because, you know, they're just
right.
passionate, and, you know, so it's great.
Any Indian authors that are your favorite?
Ooh, that's so hard. I guess Indian authors have this funny thing about, you know, a lot of them are hyphenates, but I'm thinking of the last Indian author I read whose book I loved. He's Indian British, I guess, but Hari Kunzru's Gods
yep.
Without Men.
Yep.
I love that book. Did you read it? It's just, it's so complex and multi-layered.
Yeah, I've not gotten around to that one.
Yeah,
but,
it's a great book. But I can't even, I mean, Salman Rushdie, obviously,
right.
I was one of the authors that I tried to mimic and failed. But, you know, Amitav Ghosh, there's so many. I love.
Terrific. So let's take a short break and we'll be right back. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora Radio, and I'm here with author Tanya James. Tanya, your latest book, you've just, I guess, completed it. It's being launched. The Tusk That Did the Damage. And here you have an orphaned homicidal elephant as the protagonist. So how did you get such an idea? Were you smoking something?
I wish. That's a bad answer. Well, you know, I was actually in Kerala. And I was on a Fulbright fellowship. And, you know, I was in this store, an odd little bookstore, and came across an odd little book called The Elephant Graveyard, and I mean odd in a great way. It's by a British guy, Tarkin Hall, he's a journalist, and it makes mention of this real-life elephant, which, like the elephant in my book, he also used to bury his victims, and sometimes he'd carry the body for a mile beforehand, and he would, you know, defend his own burial sites. He would prevent anyone from taking the bodies away. And to me, there's something really human in that kind of madness. And it's sort of, you know, the logic beneath it. And it made me want to know, you know, where that elephant had come from and sort of what was the tipping point that led to a life as this kind of violent rogue elephant. And so it was from there I started thinking about, you know, I wonder if an elephant's life could provide some sort of spine or some sort of trajectory over the course of a novel.
Wow. I can't wait to read it. So I guess the book is, you said, just out in the UK? Okay.
Yes, it's out in the UK now.
And when do we get to read it here in the U.S. or in India?
It'll come out in March 10th in India, and I think the same time in the U.S. and also in India then.
Fantastic. And what kind of research? I know you were in India on a Fulbright at that time. What kind of research did you do for the book? Did you go visit a lot of these jungles and national parks and stuff to do research on that?
Yes, that's exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what I did. I which is, you know, a little hard for me. I'm used to just doing my research in the library. I'm not the best interviewer. I feel like, you know, it's not even simply shyness. I just feel sort of a kind of discomfort with taking up people's time and kind of probing into their lives. But I think what, you know, most people I met were really happy to talk about their lives and their experiences. Even the poachers or people who used to be poachers, they were, you know, pretty matter of fact about what they, you know, what they'd done, what they'd been through. But I visited the Kaziranga Wildlife Park in Assam, and I spent a few days with a center there. It's the Wildlife Rescue and Rehabilitation Center. And I tagged along with a veterinary doctor there, and he's sort of an expert on these elephant calf rescues. And he does a lot of, you know, rescuing of them. And then I also interviewed forest guards and forest officers and former poachers and elephant keepers. And I went to Vainad, I went to Periyar, I went to a lot of, you know, anywhere where, you know, there's human elephant conflict and where people would talk to me, I would pretty much try to go. Mm-hmm. But the process of research for me is sort of like I don't know what I'm looking for until I've found it. So, you know, that part was fun because I'm just gathering, and then at some point you have to detach from the research and so, mm-hmm. you know, so to prevent the research from kind of taking over your imagination. But it was fun. That was really fun.
Fantastic. Can't wait to read it. Again, you know, the other thing, just staying on the topic of books, you know, reading seems to be losing popularity, at least from what we hear from the younger generation. And you've got an 11-month-old boy. So what's your, how do you encourage children to read? What's your take on that?
Well, you know, I think that the book as an object might seem outdated to younger generations, but my sense is that storytelling is just one of these things that will never go out of style. And I think, you know, we as humans are wired to want to tell stories and to hear stories. And I think back, you know, to like third grade when my teacher should read aloud to us from The Witches by Roald Dahl or Charlotte's Web. I remember being, you know, absolutely spellbound. And I believe that our attentions have sort of fragmented over time, and yes, we absorb information differently than we did, you know, 15 years ago. But I find that if the story's great and if I can remove myself from, you know, handheld devices and computers, I can still disappear inside a good book. It just takes mm-hmm. some more effort, and maybe it's a bit more of a challenge. And maybe, you know, I mean, I think you can't force kids to read, obviously. I mean, you have older kids of your own, so you probably have a better sense of this. But I have taught now for several semesters, and I notice that it's really impossible for me to force my students to love something that I love, and it always kind of breaks my heart a little bit when they don't love what I love. But they do tend to grow passionate about books that somehow speak to their own experience. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be a direct experience. I mean, it could be a fantasy novel that really has nothing to do with, you know, with the particulars of their lives. But I still am hopeful that young people can be enthusiastic and can be passionate about stories that matter to them. It's just a matter of exposing them to a diverse array and letting them decide. And so, I mean, you know, for my own son, I'm sort of operating on this assumption that he won't think I'm a total loser and that he'll actually want to hang out with me. But, you know, I mean, you know, I'm assuming that won't always be the case. But, I mean, it was great, I think. Yeah, I think about, you know, reading books with him and books I loved as a kid. And mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, he's really obsessed with these Sandra Boynton books. I don't know if you've seen these
little
you know, animal books. So I hopefully, I'm trying not to read too much into these things, but hopefully that's a start.
Terrific.
So I know in the past you've received fellowships, you know, from Ragdale Foundation, D.C. Commission on the Arts and such. So what's your involvement been with arts outside of writing?
I think those things, I guess, a big part of being a working artist is sort of hustling and, you know, going after the opportunities that are going to help you continue making, you know, creative work. I think that, you know, so that's, you know, hustling is part of my work. I started actually making the art. And then, you know, I'm finding it's really nice to get out of the world of my computer or whatever I'm working on and talking to students. I mean, I used to teach at GW. I don't anymore, but occasionally I get the opportunity to speak to a classroom of high school students through this program, the Penn Faulkner program. And that's always, you know, kind of injects a little energy into your day. I think it can be easy to get into the same old routines and kind of where writing and making art can feel sort of mechanical in a certain way. And I think that kids and students sort of throw you off your guard kind of inject a little something unpredictable into the way you're seeing the world. So that's, you know, that's, I guess, another way in which I'm involved in art, but not in the contained sphere of my own work.
So, you know, a lot of us relax. When we want to relax, we relax with a book, right? So you're a writer who is in the industry, who's thinking books all the time. So what do you do to relax?
I was thinking the other day, you know, actually I was going for a walk with no particular end point in mind. And I was thinking, this is so relaxing. And I was just like, why don't I ever do this? I'm always, you know, sort of hurrying toward a destination. But, you know, it's like I find that, you know, writers – I have talked about this, how just walking can kind of free up your mind and things can unfurl and loosen up. So, I mean, this is not something I regularly do, but I'm hoping that, you know, I can, especially, well, although it's supposed to snow tomorrow, so maybe the gods are against me, but I would like to, you know, just go for walks. I find that relaxing.
And one last question for you before we leave, and that is, what is one thing about yourself that even your close friends or your fans or readers may not know about you?
Well, I rarely like to dance. And I don't have to be in a club sort of setting. But sometimes, you know, the club is just my kitchen, and I'll put my son in his jumperoo, you know, jumperoo, suspended seat things, and he's really into Janelle Monáe right now, and he'll jump, and, you know, I'll dance, and it's really, you know, wild movements, sort of this interpretive kind of dance, and, you know, sort of pretend like no one's watching, although, you know, our neighbors could see directly into our living room. But I think that's a good metaphor for you know, making art, you know, pretend like no one's watching. But yeah, I think that's something that the fans have yet to see and hopefully will never see. But I like to dance.
Awesome. Awesome. It was great talking to you, Tanya.
Great talking to you, Emma.
Today's show was produced by Monica Patel. The theme music is by our very own Rena Ismail. The interlude music is by Jahan Shah, and so long, everyone.